TUC Radio, Time of Useful Consciousness. Richard Grossman, Dismantling Corporations. Ralph Nader called Richard Grossman the preeminent historian of corporations. In his writings and teaching, Grossman warned us that unchecked corporate power would lead to the destruction of democracy. He said that the American Revolution was fought less against the king, but against the crown corporations, the Hudson's Bay and East India corporations. And he believed that it is time to remember that fight and assert sovereignty of the people over corporations and the corporate state. In the speech you are about to hear, he calls for dismantling the 1,000 largest corporations off the face of the earth, end quote. Richard Grossman's research showed him that in the original intent of American revolutionaries, corporations did not have rights. They only had privileges, and only those that we the people bestow on them. They were to be limited by a revocable charter that specified what exactly they were allowed to do. Its board and shareholders were to be fully liable for any harm the corporation did. And they initially had none of the free speech rights that go along with personhood. If Richard Grossman were still alive today, he would be shocked to see that corporations and bankers, from Exxon to Goldman Sachs, from General Dynamics to Lockheed Martin, from Wells Fargo to pipeline builder Energy Transfer, all no longer are limited to purchasing influence by buying congresspeople one by one, but now they own and run large parts of the government directly. Here's a program I produced in 1995. I met Richard in the summer of 1995 in San Francisco. He had been invited to a retreat of the International Forum on Globalization that had formed just a year earlier. The task was to brainstorm on how best to alert the public on the consolidation of the global corporate structure enabled by the new trade agreements under the WTO. It was my job to record every speaker, and Richard's presentation made the deepest impression. For the 16 years that followed, I paid attention to his work and recorded and interviewed him on his rare visits to the West Coast. The atmosphere at the IFG retreat was friendly and organized. There was no audience. Everybody was a participant. Around the long table were some who had come from halfway around the world. They included the new members of the IFG, who later became well known, Vandana Shiva from India, Maud Barlow from Canada, to name just a few. Many met for the first time, and there was great curiosity every time a new voice was heard. Later, when I got to know Richard Grossman better, I was no longer surprised that he was provocative. Provocative not to be antagonistic, but to define a problem and fearlessly walk towards a conclusion without compromise. And whenever someone said to him, "But that's impossible," he would say, "Not if we actually take power, as others before us have done from time to time." Richard said, "You want democracy, community, an intact earth? We can't get there by obeying a law crafted by corporate masters and nature destroyers." So isn't disobedience the challenge of our age? Principled, inventive, escalating disobedience to liberate our souls, to transfigure our work as humans on this earth. End quote by Richard Grossman. But that first time that I heard him speak, his opening was a surprise. Richard Grossman.
I believe that the people around the world who see the enormous amounts of harms that are being inflicted by corporations and by governments are at a point to now forthrightly and directly announce a demand to dismantle the 1,000 largest corporations off the face of the earth. to take back what they have taken from us and take back what they have taken from the natural world in order to build the kind of communities and sustain the natural world as we think is appropriate, based on human dignity and the functioning of natural systems. I think this is necessary tactically to help us to think and to help us to plan out actually what we're going to do. And it's necessary psychologically to help us to actually believe that we can do this. It's not that the 1,000 largest corporations necessarily are the sources of all our oppression. Yes, they oppress us. Yes, they are vehicles of enormous harms. And it's not that globalization, global markets, global production is the source of all our harms. I think that those are the names of harms. When I have an inflammation of the ear and it hurts, and I go to the doctor, and the doctor tells me you have otitis. Well, I already knew that. You know, that's the name. And I'm not fighting the name. I need to figure out the source and figure out how to stop it at the source. So I'm suggesting that we target explicitly and say we want to dismantle the 1,000 largest corporations off the face of the earth because of the nature of the modern large corporation, because it is the dominant institutional form all over the world. Now, we have some precedents. So here's a little history. In the 1700s, global corporations ruled the earth, a good part of the earth. The East India Company, the Africa Company, the Hudson's Bay Company, they were corporations. They were chartered corporations, chartered by kings who ruled by divine right. The phrase, the ship of state, comes, you know, very much from the fact that the ships of chartered corporations carried all the rights and privileges of statehood. You know, they went out to pillage and murder and enslave and destroy biodiversity and destroy culture and all of that. And they came home with huge amounts of money and resources. They were the ships of state. Global corporations governed. They raised taxes. They levied people into the army and navy. They told people what work to do, what work they couldn't do. They took control of the products of labor. They told you who you could trade with and who you couldn't trade with. They told you what you could grow and what you couldn't grow. They performed all the functions of government. They ruled. And they ruled with the consent of the governed. In India, or the subcontinent of India, essentially 100,000 English people, 50,000 soldiers and 50,000 bureaucrats, governed several hundred million people. The many consented to the rule of the few. Quite an achievement, I guess. In the colonies, in this country, the colonies, many of the colonies, Massachusetts Bay Colony, the Virginia Colony, the Carolina Colonies, were corporations. They were crown corporations. They governed. They ruled. They performed all the function of government. They got their authority from the king, you know, from God. The culture of the monarchy inhibited people from thinking about the sources of their oppression. It inhibited people from thinking and acting about the rights as human beings. One of the things that Tom Paine, an American pamphleteer, did in his pamphlet Common Sense, which sold millions of copies in a very short period of time, was to remove the facade of the monarchy culture, basically tracing back the history of King George of England to Norman the Conqueror, to these guys coming over from France, you know, pillaging and raping in England, taking control, creating this whole mythology of the kingdom. And to help people see that their task as people who claimed that they were free, or were moving towards claiming that they were free, their task was actually not to negotiate with the king, not to negotiate with the ministers of the king, but in fact to focus on where the power was. And in the course of the revolution, what they did by, you know, removing the king, by going after the power at its source, removing the king, the revolution in effect became the opportunity to transform, to dismantle the crown corporations that were governing in the colonies, and to take with the assets and to take what they had and to create constitutionalized governments with elections, with mechanisms that a free people could use to control them. Elections, lawmaking, terms of office, processes where people had standing. Now, the revolution was flawed. Not all people had standing. There was a tremendous gap between the ideals and the language of the revolution, the ideals and the language of the Declaration of Independence, and the reality. And after the revolution, there was a struggle between those who wanted to make this a case of popular rule, to have the nature of governance in this country be popular rule, versus those who were seeking minority rule. And the people struggling for popular rule did the best they could. You know, they didn't win. They lost. In the process, though, they did create some tools to make it easier for future generations to resist concentrations of power and to undo those concentrations of power. One would be the very ideal, you know, the theory and ideal of the revolution, of the Declaration of Independence, and of the Constitution, the nature of the Bill of Rights. You know, the Bill of Rights, you know, preserving rights that the people had prior to their coming together to form a constitution. The Constitution begins, "We, the people of the United States, create this Constitution. We were people. We had rights as human beings. We come together, negotiate with one another in order to set up the mechanisms of self-governance." That's a legacy that some other countries share that went through similar processes at different times, and it can be a very empowering legacy. And then there are a lot of tools in there as well. One of the things that after the revolution was there was a clear sense that they were not going to turn over the ability to govern themselves to the institution of the corporation. I mean, people remembered, they had personal first-hand experience with the Hudson's Bay Company and the Crown corporations. The idea of the revolution was not to turn over their rights and their property and all of that to these other institutions. And so there was a very clear sense in law and in the popular culture that, in fact, corporations, the charter of incorporation, the license to incorporate, was a privilege. It was a public trust, and it was conditional. And the people, through the legislatures, defined the corporations through the charter and through the state corporation laws. It wasn't the case that people were saying, we're going to define the level of harm we allow them to do to us. It says, we will define the very nature of these institutions. We will say how much capital they can concentrate in one place. We will make them all liable, the directors and the shareholders and the officers will make them liable for the harms that they caused. We will give them a time limit. You can have this charter for 5 years, and then you have to come back to us, and we'll decide whether or not we should renew it. You'll have to come to us and say what projects you want to do with the privilege of incorporation, and we'll either say yes and we'll no. Condition after condition after condition. And the two fundamental conditions were, I mean, they weren't even conditions, they were the fundamental realities, were that the people, the sovereign people, people who had been through this struggle of the revolution, were in fact sovereign over the subordinate institution that was the fiction called the corporation. What the people can create, the people can uncreate. So they reserved the right in the charters themselves and in the state corporation law to amend the charter and to revoke the charter for cause, for abuse and all that, but also at whim, because the people were sovereign. When the people are sovereign, you don't need a reason if you choose to take it back. So the literature, the history, the legacy is very, very rich. The two phrases through the 19th century, the legal phrases that were the processes to raise the issue in the public forums and in the constitutionalized process of a free people, in legislatures, in the courts, and in the press, to talk about what corporations were doing that were causing harm with two Latin phrases. Mm-hmm. One is quo warranto, by what authority? You know, it wasn't too many parts per million. You know, it wasn't you're not allowing union people to organize. It was by what authority have you taken this action? That was the basis of convening the legal process to determine. And the second was ultra vires. What you have done is beyond your authority. So the very phrases and the process reflect the relationship that the people in those days saw existing between the sovereign people, as defined, limited and flawed, but as defined, and this legal fiction that was the corporation. Quickly enough, by the end of the century, a counter-revolution had taken place. After the Civil War, banks, railroad corporations, grain corporations, other corporations, became powerful enough to, in fact, undo in law this theory, and to, in fact, to place the government as a barrier between the institution of the corporation and the sovereign people. You know, by creating the beginning of the regulatory and administrative state, the Interstate Commerce Commission, the Sherman Antitrust Law, where the bedrock principles were not the people's sovereignty, but the laws of the market, which is a very sinister thing, because when, in fact, we, the people, consent to the elevation of the laws of the market over the laws of a sovereign people who come together to negotiate our rights and our mechanisms of dealing with one another, then you automatically elevate the institution of the market to being beyond the authority of the people. And that's the corporation. And so what you had was a transformation in property rights and laws. What you had was the people consenting to the giving of corporations more rights than people had. Corporations were declared persons by the Supreme Court of the United States. What that meant was they now had equal protection of the law. They had the full faith and protection of the United States government. The Bill of Rights, the First Amendment, which was to preserve the human rights of free speech and assembly and practice of religion, in order to resist concentrations of power, in order to help future generations of people to govern themselves, then became a tool of the corporation. Once the corporations become persons, then they have free speech. Once they have free speech, you cannot pass laws. You know, a municipality or a state or the Congress can't pass a law to say this: no corporation may participate and undermine the fundamental sacred mechanisms of a free people. Elections, lawmaking, judicial proceedings, and the press, information. The positive, powerful legacy of the American Revolution, despite its flaws, and the tools that were supposed to be entrusted to the next generation have gone by the wayside. And we have consented over this last 100 years to putting our time and energy as activist citizens into arenas which are fundamentally, for the most part, not about power. They're not about self-governance. When we get involved in regulatory administrative struggles on the nature of pollution, and on whether we should have 60-day notice for a plant closing, those are not about fundamental self-governance and authority over who makes the rules as to where money is invested, under what terms it's invested, who controls our labor, who controls the products of our labor, and what rights we have as free people, as sovereign people, to organize our communities and our regions and our societies as we choose. The other thing that happened also in the 1890s, at the time of this consolidation of corporate power, was the parallel pushing of the United States into the world arena, onto the backs of the world. I mean, that's when we took the Philippines, Cuba, and driven by the corporation, looking for resources and world markets. So there was a real connection there. Now, the 1890s was also the last citizen effort to challenge the corporate state, the populist movement. Urban workers, intellectuals, and farmers coming together to form the populist movement, 1885 to the end of the century, 1896. People were very clear that they were suffering harms at the hands of corporations, but that corporations had become the rulers. And so the slogans of all the farmers' parties and the people's parties was, we have to end the corporate state. They weren't talking about regulating the corporations to decrease the amount of harms that they were doing. They weren't talking about legalizing poisoning. They were talking about ending the corporate state and resurrecting the ideals of self-governance. Except for some blips in this century, after World War I and after World War II, we've been very compliant. We've been submissive. We've been playing in their ballpark, under their rules, within what has become the equivalent of the monarchy culture, which I think is a corporate colonial culture. They've gotten our language. They've taken our minds. I think they've taken our ability to a large extent to strategize. They've affected how we think and how we talk to one another. When, in fact, I'm speaking on environmental issues, environmental people coming to be environmentalists in the 50s and 60s started to raise the questions of poisons in the air and poisons in the water. So people respond and say, oh, there are poisons in the air and the poisons in the water. We want this taken care of. So what did we, the environmental movement, do? Speaking broadly. Well, we sought and passed laws that legalized poisoning. You know, we sought and passed the National Environmental Policy Act, which is considered the cornerstone of environmental regulation of this era. Well, it doesn't mention the word corporation. It does not apply to corporations. It has nothing to do with dealing with addressing the relationship between the sovereign people and the institution of the corporation, which has been the primary decider of where capital goes, what's made, and how it's made. The National Labor Relations Act, the Wagner Act in the 1930s, it had many positive virtues. And regulation has saved a lot of people. But what happened with labor was that they saw it and agreed, and there was opposition at the time, but they saw it and agreed to a law where the government defined the rights of people, workers, to associate together, defined their rights and defined what they could even talk about. The fundamental issues, the most important ones, investment, the nature of production, the organization of work, defined it off the agenda. And so workers' movements in the place where the issues were the most fundamental, where in fact people could feel internally every day what was happening, the fundamental issues that determined how people live, that determined what people made, that determined the nature of production, was off the agenda. Of course there was a conflict between jobs and the environment, because we had given up our authority over the fundamental question of money and production and the nature of work. Chartering is a tool, like many tools, and it's about defining the corporation and defining our relations with it. When we challenge the existence, the authority of the corporations, we set up a kind of struggle out of which these issues become clear. One of the things that we could do is seek to amend the existing charters of corporations and revoke the charters of existing corporations. First of all, it hasn't been done. It hasn't been attempted of a big corporation for a century. I mean, it's a whole area with a very rich history and a lot of opportunities. We actually engaged some lawyers to look into the press and say, what would it mean? And we got back all kinds of papers and memos explaining the precedents and what it would mean. What became clear is that what a revocation of a charter means is a political issue. It fundamentally depends on how powerful the people's movements who are driving this are. You know, if we're talking about taking their assets, taking our assets back in order to use what's usable to reconfigure our communities and getting corporations out of the mechanisms of a democratic people, we go on the offensive. We create a whole new realm in which we have tools and legacies and in which in this country, it's in the popular culture. These ideals, the notion of sovereignty, it's in the popular culture, even if it's been neglected and not utilized. Why not take on frontally the doctrine of personhood? Why not take on the doctrine of managerial prerogative, that corporations have all these rights over investment, over production, over the nature of work, and over the organization of work? You know, why not begin to seek a bill of rights for workers? Not a bill of rights, the bill of rights. Workers don't have free speech. They don't have rights of assembly. They have no redress of grievances. You know, corporations are not constitutionalized. They are governed, but they are authoritarian, perpetual governments. And next, almost lastly, what are we, a free people, what are we doing allowing fictions to be sullying the mechanisms of a free people? Why are corporations in elections in any way? So to me, the issue is not let's get money out of politics. Let's get corporations out of elections. Same thing with legislation. What are corporations doing lobbying? Why do we permit that? Lawmaking is for a free people. These are fictions. Why are they there? They should be out. Mariah mentioned the work of Alex Carey, and many other people have done work on the NAM and the Chamber of Commerce and the Chemical Manufacturers Association. All these, what we honor them by calling them trade associations. They're corporations of the corporations. And they are the ones who are driving legislation. They are the ones that are driving elections. They are driving the rewriting of the laws and the interpreting of the laws, and they are driving our press and our information. The basic mechanisms of a free people, we have given up to these legal fictions. In the United States, we have a special obligation given the role of the United States on the backs of the rest of the world. That if we in the United States begin to focus on dismantling the 300 or so of the largest corporations in the world that are chartered in the United States, you know, maybe we can give some space and some room to the struggles in other countries. You know, maybe we can legitimate in this bastion of corporate and capital control, we can legitimate the idea that a free people doesn't have to operate, internalize the corporate culture. That we, in fact, can believe that what exists now was not inevitable, is not irreversible, is the most efficient, leads to the most freedom, and all that junk. That we don't have to concede that the laws of the market supersede the laws that human beings, free human beings, sentient human beings, coming together to negotiate with each other can make. We have to remember that we, that free people, do not negotiate with governments. We don't negotiate with corporations. We negotiate with one another. And I think, under all, we need to shift from these cultures of resistance to harms one at a time, or to save one forest at a time, or to fight one corporation at a time, to cultures of struggle, which are about self-governance. That the vision is self-governance, and the path will then come out of the struggles that people are involved with all the time. Frederick Douglass said, I'll give it a mangled paraphrase, power concedes nothing without a struggle. Not to believe that is to believe that we can harvest crops without plowing the ground. Now, what makes me optimistic is I don't think for 100 years that we have thought about, in a serious, long-term way, engaging in struggle for self-government against the concentrated powers that are arrayed against us. And that is something we begin to do, and the corporations are the path into that.
That was Richard Grossman on Dismantling Corporations, a talk that could have been given yesterday. Instead, it was recorded in 1995 at a retreat of the International Forum on Globalization. Richard Grossman was an early voice in the movement to not just revoke personhood and repeal the charter of corporations, but to challenge the corporate state. Richard died of melanoma on November 22, 2011. In the last 15 years, he had been an important member of POCLAD, the Project on Corporations, Law and Democracy, and CELDEF, the Community Environmental Legal Defense Fund. His and CELDEF's lasting legacy are the democracy schools that continue to be taught across the country. They examine the history of the rise of corporate power and devise strategies for disrupting that power. You can hear this program again on TUC Radio's website, tucradio.org. That's tucradio.org. Look under newest programs. TUC Radio is free to all radio stations and depends on the support of listeners like you. Your donation keeps this program on the air. Time of useful consciousness is an aeronautical term. It's the time between the beginning of oxygen deficiency and the loss of consciousness. Time for useful projects to rescue the planet and the plane. My name is Maria Gelöden. Thank you for listening.